Hi, this is Paul. In my last video, I talked about James Lindsay's drive-by on the Twitter Bros and Bras, Ortho Bros and Bras. And I want to do a little bit more into what I alluded to, talking about the Enlightenment, talking about modernity, talking about really what Jonathan Peugeot was referring to in the tweet that James said, this is ridiculous, because it actually is, I think, the big story for our time right now, around which a whole lot of religious, philosophical, and scientific wheels are turning. I want to go back to this conversation. This conversation, Jordan, I think, was still in suffering from the akathisia that Michaela described. And Jonathan then says, you've sort of got your feet on two different places. And we can understand those two different places in a variety of ways. Jonathan will sort of frame it as Christianity and secular humanism. And that certainly is one way to think about it. I think another way is the fact that the post-Enlightenment world continues to accelerate. And that is, in fact, what is provoking a lot of the transformations in people right now.
It's a pain level that's hard to fathom in some sense, because I would say every single day I have now is worse than any day I ever had in my life before I got ill.
Mm-hmm.
So
now one of the things that you'll see, I'm going to use the video that was just released from Chris Williamson of a very recent After Arc, in fact, conversation with Jordan Peterson. I don't know if I have heard Peterson like this again since 2017, and even earlier, perhaps. He seems healthier now. He seems sharper now. This book that he's writing, he has a tremendous amount of optimism in that this will be his most important book, and it could be. And his aspirations for this book are dramatic. So let's play a little bit of this, and then we're going to go to the other on the Enlightenment.
And then I know very well that adding bitterness to your malaise is a very bad idea. You know, it doesn't help, but that I can certainly see the attraction in that. I feel like shaking my fist at the sky and complaining bitterly, but it doesn't help, but there doesn't seem to be any relief either. And so it's so perverse. It's shaken my faith, I suppose. I'm in this perverse position where my work has in principle helped so many people, and yet I don't seem to be able to dig myself out of my current circumstances. So
now Glenn Scrivener recently just posted a video on Jordan, which reemphasized the point that I had made about Jordan's posture with respect to faith, which has tended to be an Augustinian anthropology and a Pelagian soteriology. And for most of you listening, you probably just didn't understand a thing I said, which I probably shouldn't have said it at all. But a lot of Jordan's work is advice giving, wisdom, helping people sort themselves out. And here in this, he was in this place where he couldn't help himself. Now there are a lot of people around him helping him, and he in fact has healed, and he certainly can take some credit for that. But for me as a pastor, it just goes to emphasize to me that the bigger frame tends to be the grace of God, and the grace of God given to people to heal and change and grow again.
Well,
or even to make sense of them.
Yeah. I think that the role that you played is a kind of a transition role, and that transition manifests itself to you as a trying to have your feet on two sides of rifting of an two islands that are floating away from each other, and you're trying to hold on, you're trying to kind of help people focus on the middle and help people avoid radicalization and avoid falling into camps in a manner that will lead to God knows what. And so I think that that's the role that you played. And it's been, like, I've seen, for example, people transition through your work, transition from worlds, moving worlds. That's really what I've seen happen. It's more than just...
And I think Peugeot is right. I've watched the same thing. People are transitioning from worlds, but to figure out what those worlds consist of, that in a lot of way is what we're doing here. Now, there are lots of transitions that you can point to, and many of you have taken a transition. I mentioned it after the Chino conference, where, you know, some of you 5 years ago were fans of Sam Harris, and then you were on the floor of the St. Andrew's Church kissing a box full of relics and bones. Oh, that's a big transition. And so when James Lindsay reacts to magic, this is very old code that is being replayed. And it was sort of like when Sam came into the corner, and as a Unitarian, and a bunch of people sort of reacted strongly. It's sort of like those videos on YouTube where you take the cucumber and you kind of slide it next to the cat and the cat jumps away. This was sort of built into them in terms of, oh, Trinity, attack or defend. There's all this old code that's built into us that we don't even know it's there. And we don't even know we have taken this code on. And, you know, especially for someone like Mary Cohen, who made this transition from being a Jehovah Witness then into the Roman Catholic Church, became from being a non-Trinitarian to a Trinitarian. And so she picked up a lot of this code and reacted to it. A lot of this stuff is rumbling around inside of us within these packets of code that we have taken in that have been transforming us, and it's moving around. And so underneath the surface, I think Jonathan is right. This is often the sense I've had with Jordan, that he's got a foot on each side, and they're moving away from each other. And part of what I saw in the Chris Williamson video is that increasingly he is making the transition to the new land. Increasingly, he is making the transition into a new life, into a new perspective. And that doesn't mean it's divorced from what he did with Maps of Meaning. He very much was working on it with Maps of Meaning, and he's been working on it all along. But this transition is now further underway a couple of years after this video than it was obviously then, and definitely more so than, let's say, pre-first wave C16 in the year 2016.
Just changing people transition through your work, transition from worlds, moving worlds. That's really what I've seen happen. It's more than just changing your opinion or changing your mind about something. It really is about changing the world you inhabit. And so that's a crazy role to play. And especially because, like I said, you have your foot, it's like you kind of have your one foot or one eye, let's say, looking towards, I would call religion, or looking towards Christianity or something like that. And then you have another eye, which is still very much immersed in a kind of secular humanism. And you have one leg that is, you know, you understand people that are more left-leaning, you understand people that are more right-leaning, you have this capacity to kind of understand everybody, but that means that you make enemies on all sides too.
Well, you know, the overwhelming
and it's not just understanding, it's the fact that he himself is making this transition. And again, what we've seen in the Chris Williamson video is the progress in this tradition. And the way transitions happen in people, so we can use the elephant and the rider, the Jonathan Haidt image. It takes a while for the rider to get the words together to interpret what the elephant has been doing And this is what we've seen happening in Peterson. So here Chris Williamson really starts to dig into a little bit more of Jordan's new book.
What would have to happen after the publishing of We Who Wrestle With God for you to look back on that publication and consider it a success? What is it that you want to happen? What do you want people to feel or to take away from that work?
I think we're at the beginning of the counter-enlightenment. The propositions, the enlightenment view of man is wrong. And this, you know, out of the enlightenment view came science. But the science now indicates that the enlightenment view of man is wrong.
What do you mean?
Well, the enlightenment types believe that we could orient ourselves in the world, let's say empirically, that, and this is Sam Harris's proposition, you can abide by the facts. You can orient yourself as a consequence of the dispassionate analysis of the facts.
Now, how is this germane? Of course, this is James Lindsay's proposition. This is James Lindsay against magic. And now, the difficulty is that there's a lot tied to this. And even though underneath the ground is shifting, that makes people anxious about what's tied to it. It makes me anxious too, because as I've mentioned in many previous videos, a lot of what the world has enjoyed for the last couple of hundred years has been a ceasefire in a lot of warfare about ontology. I'll say it that way. That secularity sort of covered everything up and said, here, let's just... Jordan Peterson had a nice video a long time ago where he talked about the fact that the reason they make cars look the way they do is that cars are very complex inside, and people don't know much about the engine or anything like that. So you make it a nice, pretty color, and you make it just look simple. Secularity did that. And you had this world of facts, and if we can just stick to the facts, then we don't have to bother fighting about Christian dogma. You don't have blasphemy laws. You don't have all of these things. And you can, you know, it was the hope of having peace in the post-reformational context, and things could be stable. And they have been. But that stability is breaking up. And it's breaking up for reasons that no one is going to stop. And even though Pinker, Harris, Lindsay, many others want to keep putting the brakes on, it's not going to stop. And the way people are going to deal with this is they're going to jump back into legacy religions. Under secularity, there was the idea that, oh, all religions are the same. Well, many religions have a degree of commonalities, and I actually want to make a video about some of that because it is important, and it's beneath this layer of presumed commonalities that actually Jesus has been doing a lot of smuggling. Sort of the world put a blanket over it and called it secularity, and Jesus just kept working underneath. And now that is coming off, and suddenly the religions are once again exposed, and it's going to get very interesting. I did the video before the one on James Lindsay was the one on Sarah Hyder, and that video for me really sort of opened my eyes to how unfinished business between Christianity and Islam is going to reemerge. But interestingly enough, I suspect Islam is going to find itself in a really difficult position because more and more Christian code has been put into a lot of Muslims. And it's going to be very interesting to see how these conversations go. That is to say nothing of what's going to happen between Protestants and Catholics and Orthodox. And that conversation is already underway.
You can't. And the fact,
what do you mean?
Well, the Enlightenment types believe that we could orient ourselves in the world, let's say empirically, that, and this is Sam Harris's proposition, you can abide by the facts. You can orient yourself as a consequence of the dispassionate analysis of the facts. You can't. And I would say the artificial intelligence engineers have figured that out. The postmodern literary critics have figured that out. The psychologists and physiologists of perception have figured it out. And the neuroscientists have figured that out. So it's not just the evidence that that view is necessarily incorrect, is overwhelming and multidimensional. You can't orient yourself by the facts. Why? Because there are as many facts as there are things. In fact, if you combine things, the nature of the combination is also a fact. So there's as many facts as there are things and combinations of things. Well, you can't orient yourself by that. That's, you drown in chaos. It's like you're standing in the desert and there's an infinite number of directions you could go. Well, how do you choose a direction?
And that's showing up in that most recent survey that I just mentioned, people feeling meaninglessness, purposelessness.
Right.
I'm
lost.
Overwhelmed.
They're lost
by...
in the desert.
Yep.
They're lost in the desert. That's, and the desert is the desert of facts. It's dead facts.
Especially given how few people can agree on, is this a fact or is this counterfact?
Well, that's also a problem, is that it's not like the facts are necessarily self-evident. Some facts are, and I suppose to some degree, what the scientific corpus is the elaboration of a set of incontrovertible facts. I've read recently that the whole Big Bang narrative is starting to come apart. You know, that was a fact for a long time. Now, I don't know if that's the case. I don't know enough about it. But my sense is that the new discoveries from the Webb telescope have made many of the presumptions upon which the Big Bang model was based questionable. So now, I don't want to, you know, fall down a postmodern rabbit hole, because although the issue of what constitutes a fact is a very complicated issue. Anyways, you can cut to the chase by pointing out that we organize facts in a hierarchy of value. And see, the thing about, I'm trying to make this case in the book. You do this when you look at the world. You can't look at the world except through a hierarchy of value. So for
now, if you go back to the first conversation, it was the third conversation he had with Sam Harris that was recorded. It was the first one that he had, that series of four big meetings with Brett Weinstein. This was the point he kept trying to make to Sam Harris, and Sam Harris wouldn't engage. It was, I made the illustration that Jordan Peterson kept trying to think about two kids trying to do something in a room. Jordan Peterson kept trying to build something and say, Sam, build with me, Sam. And Sam was just interested in kicking it over because Sam, I want to stick to the world of facts. But then Sam has this other thing he wants to play with, which is meditation. And I don't know that he knows exactly all that he's playing with. But Sam, just facts, facts, facts. And meditation is just something that happens in my head, between my ears. And no, Jordan also in this video has a terrific piece where he talks about sanity. And it was a number of months ago that he was on this kick. And I was pointing to that too, because he's exactly right that sanity isn't just between your head. Sanity is your relationship to reality. That's what sanity is. And it's intersubjective, it's communal, it's spiritual, it's multidimensional.
For example, as we're sitting here, there's an infinite number of places we could be pointing our eyes. Like I could be talking to you and looking at this little spot on the concrete floor, or the spot beside it, or the infinite number of spots surrounding it constantly, but I'm not. I'm looking at your eyes. Okay, why? Because I'm prioritizing them. So the fact that dominates in this landscape is the fact of your eyes. Why? I can use your eyes to evaluate our shared focus, right? And that's why we look at other people's eyes.
It's also why human.
And by shared focus, that's not just physical. In a conversation, their shared focus within the conversation. Well, what exactly is that? And where does that exist? And again, if you look at these issues, these are all issues that he tried to engage Sam Harris with, and Sam Harris just didn't have any interest in. And, you know, so in some ways, James Lindsay and Jonathan Peugeot on Twitter, Jordan Peterson had four sessions with Sam Harris, and I don't think they really got anywhere at all, except maybe strengthening their own relationship and building a little bit more trust with each other, which is not nothing. But in terms of what people are looking for and the size of this worldview transformation is enormous.
Humans have got white around
focus, right? And that's why we look at other people's eyes.
It's also why humans have got white around the outside.
Exactly. It's so that we can see what other people are attending to, so that we can get insight into the story.
So today I had meetings and I had to have the service dog with me, the service dog that we are training. And it's very difficult to have to mind the service dog and pay attention to the meeting when I'm doing both at the same time. Because one of the things I'm always doing is paying attention to the attention of the dog. Because the attention of the dog is what the whole business of training the dog is about. Because the whole purpose of training is the dog has to pay attention to me and respond to me or the future person for whom this service dog will be an incredibly important tool. That's where the whole point is having the dog's attention paid to me. And it's a puppy, and it's a very active puppy, and it's a very hard thing for that puppy to focus. And we know this with human beings. I've raised 5 children. And one of the things that you do with children is, again, you learn to communally and collectively focus attention. And the children basically, the first draft that the children absorb that they get from you and from the world and from all kinds of things, but they often get from you because we do our sense making through each other, is all about what to pay attention to. A woman came to coffee break this morning. So first we had coffee break and I had the dog, and then I had another meeting to go to. But a woman came to coffee break this morning and said, the service engine light just came on in my car. And as a pastor, you are dealing with almost anything imaginable under the sun with respect to people. And okay, your service engine light came on. And she's an older woman who's, you know, she's got some medical issues and she doesn't live that far from church, but car reliability for her is a very big deal. And I said, well, how well did the car run on the way here? Well, it ran fine. Okay, so it could be a whole variety of things. Your car should be able to get you home. Her husband was home. He could come and get her if there was a problem. And she had a couple little errands she wanted to run, so on and so forth. But again, this was all about attention, and I had to take that service engine light and in her mind reassure her that she should be able to make her run her little errands, which also were not far, and then probably get back home and then get her car to a mechanic, put in the little thing, read what the code is, find out exactly what has thrown the service engine light in her 2001 Toyota pickup truck. Attention. Attention. A little later in the video, he's going to have another good section on thinking versus attention. But the point here is that part of what we have learned over the last few hundred years, remember Peugeot was talking about not this one. Rockabye lock on the treetop. When the wind blows, the enlightenment will rock. When the bough breaks, the enlightenment will fall, and down will come freedom, the enlightenment and all. As Peterson's going to say later in this video, the enlightenment isn't going away. And that's part of the reason I noted the spiral dynamics thing, because these things don't really go away. Medieval Christianity didn't go away. Medieval Christianity understood that the pagan world, the classical world, didn't really go away. It had to be in some ways incorporated into the bigger story. And but things are going to change. And part of my anxiety about the end of secularism, which I share with people who are, let's say, wanting to keep secularism from ending, is that secularism afforded a whole variety of things that we have enjoyed, such as peace between the world, the legacy world religions, on a level that we've never imagined it before. I think in many ways that has, Christianity has done a lot to contribute to that. But that's a very large, very complex thing. So Peterson frames it as a counter-enlightenment, sort of like a counter-reformation. I don't know if I would say a counter, but I think it will be the final digestion of the Enlightenment, and other things are going to come forward. But we know that these kinds of transitions are not quick, and they're usually very messy.
A story is a description in space, right? And that's why we look at other people's eyes.
It's also why humans have got white around the outside.
Exactly. It's so that we can see what other people are attending to, so that we can get insight into the story. A story is a description of a hierarchy of value.
Stories can be fantastical, though, right? If they're untethered to anything, I can make a Harry Potter's a story.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's
if they're untethered to anything, you won't find them interesting.
Because they won't resonate.
They won't grip you.
Mm.
Yeah, they're tethered. Stories are tethered to reality in a very, very complicated way. Because reality...
So if you go back to... If you go back to the J.K. Rowling's... The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling's, that podcast. That story gripped a lot of people. And it gripped a lot of people to the degree that people understood themselves by the story. We have lots of words that do this. The story resonated with them. They interpreted the world through the story of Harry Potter. We do this all the time with stories. And Peterson basically is asserting, as he has for a long time, that the Bible is the foundational story of the West.
He isn't what presents itself moment to moment. It's complicated. Stories are tethered to reality in a very, very complicated way. Because reality isn't what presents itself moment to moment. There's a huge debate among philosophers about mathematical abstractions. Are they real? Well, you could make a case that a mathematical abstraction is more real than the thing from which it's abstracted. How would you make that case? If you're a master of mathematics, you master the world. So are the mathematical abstractions more or less real? Narrative abstractions are abstractions. But you could say, this is what an archetype is. An archetype is a narrative abstraction that's more real than the world, than the apparent world. It's behind the scenes. And the biblical corpus is a narrative. It's a hyper-real narrative. That's the right way to think about it. It's more real than real. More real than reality.
How could something that isn't the thing be more real than the thing?
Well, that's exactly the problem with abstraction, right? Is the idea of a church more real than a given church?
Let's pause and ponder this point a little bit more. So James is a conceptual James. James Lindsay is a mathematician. An engineer uses mathematical models before they build the bridge. The same mathematical models are used for bridge after bridge after bridge because these models work. We've been talking for a very long time. At the heart of a lot of what these conversations engage in is the question, what is real? So what we're seeing are sort of the two realities, and we're wrestling with the relationship between them. Every model of a bridge, based on, let's say, physics, mathematical models, has a reality that every instantiation of a bridge does not have. it's a governing reality. And this is where Jordan is talking about an archetype. But a bridge is a relatively simple construct. And it's something that we can understand, sort of the relationship between math and engineering and that bridge. So in some ways, the math behind the bridge is eternal. It's timeless. It's not subject to decay. It just is. So in some ways, that's more real. But an actual bridge is also has an aspect of reality that the model doesn't have. That aspect of reality is tested because there's complexity in the bridge that the model does not have. And this is where what Jordan just laid out a minute ago about number of facts, number of things, and the relationship between them. This is what John Vervaeke talks about in terms of combinatorial explosiveness. The physical bridge has a combinatorial explosiveness that the model in the engineer's head or on the engineer's computer does not have. And so the reality between them is a very complex thing. In some ways, the model governs the physical bridge. In other ways, the physical bridge can never really live up to the model. It can exceed the model in some cases, but it has a reality other than the model. And so you say, well, which one is more real? There's sort of realities of different kinds. And the tension between these two realities has been the subject of philosophical debate and conversation for a very, very long time. What happens in, let's say, physicalism or materialism is that we have tended to say the engineer's model is a derivation from the instantiation of the bridge. And you can go back to Plato and Aristotle up and down with this whole thing. Like I said, this has been a conversation for a very long time. But the other side is that it works the other way around. And so when Peterson notes an archetype, these stories precede the instantiations of them, and in many ways physically do. And in terms of the instrumental cause, they do. And part of the reason that we study mathematics and engineering and physics is because we know these things govern here. The immaterial, mathematical, physical, the laws govern. The difficulty that we have is that the promise of materialism was, well, let's say if we can discover all of these laws without asking too many questions about why we're framing them as laws and where they come from and why they're so durable, et cetera, then we can sort of slip behind and govern the whole thing. And part of what we're discovering is that, well, bridges are relatively simple things. Human beings are far more complex than bridges. Human relationships are even more complex than human beings.
Well, it is in some ways than real. It's more real than reality.
How could something that isn't the thing be more real than the thing?
Well, that's exactly the problem with abstraction, right? Is the idea of a church more real than a given church? Well, it is in some ways, because it encapsulates what's similar across all churches, right? So it's like a Platonic ideal. A category is like a Platonic ideal. Is it more or less real? Well, you could say that the reality, this is what Plato said, the reality is a dim shadow of the essence. The reality is less real than the ideal. And we certainly, and that's actually in some ways built into our perception. Like we criticize the things that present themselves to us because they are poor reflections of the hypothetical ideal.
You might say, well, the ideal isn't real. It's like, well, you could make the opposite argument, which is that the ideal is more real than the thing itself.
He also in this video has a lot of some really practical things to talk about marriage and relationships. But just pay attention to couples fighting. They're fighting about ideals. Sometimes it's which ideal. Other times it's individual performance on the way to the ideal. These ideals are built into us. Now, in a sense, if you're a thoroughgoing materialist, you could say, well, the ideals are just projections. Oh, but we don't act that way. Because the difficulty that the materialist has is once they begin to employ an ideal, it immediately undermines the system that they are using. Because the ideal is, in their definition, has to be less real. It's simply a derivative of all of the instantiations. And therefore, it need not govern because it is an it's a derivation that is done by ourselves, upper registers that are themselves derivations. It sort of knocks on the door of this argument that Alvin Plantinga and C.S. Lewis make, that John Lennox made. I mentioned it in a video a little while ago, where if you argue that evolution is simply the product of blind random choice, then so are our thoughts, and so are our abilities to estimate, and so are our abilities to even accept an evaluation that we make. In other words, there's nothing to stand on. If you lose an ideal, which is a little later, also in this video, he's going to talk about truth. If you lose that ideal, you really don't have anything. And then you're probably going to be in nihilism-induced depression.
I mean, I can give you an example of these patterns. So in the story of Cain and Abel, you have two patterns of sacrifice. Okay. Why is sacrifice an issue? The reason it's an issue is because people exist in a sacrificial relationship to the world. What does that mean? It seems to mean something like human beings are aware of their extended self. You know you're going to be around tomorrow and next week and next month and next year and 5 years from now and 10 years from now. Now it's less certain as you go out, but you do have the sense of yourself as something that stretches across the decades. Okay, and so what that means is that you have to conduct yourself in a manner that isn't merely immediate. You have to conduct yourself in a manner that will work across time. Now, how do people do that? They work. Work is a sacrificial gesture. So you work, by definition, virtually. Work is the sacrifice of the present for the future. I mean, maybe someone can come up with a better definition of work than that, but I don't think so. It's like you put in time and effort right now. It's something, even if it's something maybe not what you'd like to be doing at the moment, you put in time and effort because you believe, what the hell does that mean? You believe it'll pay off. Well, is that a contract with the future?
That's faith. That's what that is. That's faith. And pistis in Greek, often it's translated in a lot of contemporary translations, believe, but it's also faith. And that is, in fact, what faith is. It's not believing without evidence. It's actually, in terms of your behavior, trusting. That's the other, that's the word in that little trio. Believe, faith, trust. It's trusting in, well, trusting in what? Trusting in a whole lot of things.
Sure. Is it a covenant? Because the relationship that the biblical corpus insists characterizes human striving is covenantal. It's a bargain. The bargain is you make the right sacrifices and they pay off.
And the question is, what are you bargaining with? Or better yet, who are you bargaining with? Because whenever it's merely a what, our sneaky little agency tries to find a way to game that. But when it's a who, we don't operate under the spirit of geometry. We operate under the spirit of finesse, because we always deal with agents with a whole lot more care, especially agents that have power.
That's the bargain. Now, you might say, well, that's just part of the social contract, but the biblical corpus insists that it's deeper than that. It's built into the structure of reality itself, and that if you got the sacrifices right, the future would be paradisal.
I've got it in my head, that Carl Jung quote, "Beware of unearned wisdom."
Mm-hmm.
That feels like it plays a role here, like how the work that you need to put in order to be able to arrive at genuinely knowing the thing, mm-hmm. the difference between actually being attractive because who you are is attractive, mm-hmm. and you being able to be a pickup artist, mm-hmm. that is able to make the mouth noises and the hand gestures that causes,
you know,
those the thing
are,
to
those
occur.
Are
the pickup artist thing is referring to an earlier part of the this is a 3-hour plus conversation. We haven't had, I don't know that we've had a Peterson video this good and this much of it for a very long time.
The fruits of false sacrifice, you could say that unearned moral reputation is the consequence of false sacrifice.
Well, this is right? Performative empathy, mm-hmm. right?
Sure, exactly.
On the internet.
Definitely. That's the same as praying in public. Look at how good I am. If the look at comes before the how good I am.
Jordan is sneaking in the Sermon on the Mount here, just leaving the footnote. That's exactly what he's doing, and this is how Jesus sneaks all around, where people don't see him. But Jordan is using the Sermon on the Mount right here.
Right. It really wreaks havoc on the good claim.
It's also, I spoke to Douglas about this, it seems to almost be a predictor. It's an identifier that you should be a little bit more cautious about what this person's doing.
Definitely.
You know, every single person that's super sweety and nicey, Lizzo. Do you see Lizzo was in the news recently?
No.
So she is a artist, singer.
She the one that got in trouble for abusing her close compatriots.
Yeah. Her dancers, yeah. She made her dancers eat bananas out of the vaginas of Amsterdamian strippers. Douglas said that he...
Oh, yeah, that's a little on the hedonistic power mad side.
Well, she was supposed to be, you know, this bassy, like, for the girls and body positivity and all this stuff, but it turned out behind the scenes that she was treating her dancers terribly, body shaming them all of the time, but she was the one up front that was the vanguard of this particular movement. But you'd seen the same with, was it Jimmy Fallon? I think he was caught up in a furor recently that he was a tyrant to work for, and yet out front. Ellen DeGeneres, again, the same. It's almost... actually, like, if somebody is,
it's very much like that,
overloading on the sweetie nicey, I am here for the underlings, that you go, I'm a little bit suspicious of what's going on there. If you need to proclaim your purity and your good standing, if it's all words,
Sermon on the Mount, be careful not to practice your righteousness for men to see.
And opinions are not deeds.
One of the commandments, one of the Ten Commandments, is do not use God's name in vain. Okay, now people think that means don't swear. And it sort of means that. That's one of its like tangential meanings. But what it really means is do not claim divine motivation for self-serving behavior. Right, and that's performative compassion. So what you do is you elevate compassion to the highest place. So you make it your God, which is a big mistake, because whatever God is, he is not merely compassion. You elevate compassion to the highest place. And then you say, I feel sorry for people. And what that does is elevate your moral status to the highest possible place, right? It's completely unearned, because this is something J.K. Rowling got so accurate with her Dolores Umbridge character, right? Who's an absolute power mad
always
tyrant.
Always in pink,
with
had
little
the cats.
Kittens, had the kittens on the plates. Yeah. It's like this toxic sentimentality. I'm so nice. It's like, I'd like to stay away from you and your devouring niceness. And the Freudians knew about that very, in a very sophisticated way, very early, because the devouring mother, the Oedipal mother, is the shadow side of compassion.
I've been trying to come up with a term for this for a while. I like memeing things into existence, giving them names. Useful.
Now, before he does his meme thing, which I think is actually really good, we were talking about ideals or archetypes and reality. Now, here again, now we sort of, you know, you probably forgot that we were talking about this, but this is a terrific example of it. This Oedipal mother, this Oedipal mother, this Dolores Umbridge is, now you've never met anyone, you've never met Dolores Umbridge, she's a fictional character, but you've met people like her. And so you might say, well, I've met a lot of people. Yeah, but the ideal of this instantiation, you feel the reality of this instantiation and people participate in that spirit and they give themselves to that spirit. And that's, and the way they give themselves to that spirit is not simply a woo thing. They give themselves to that spirit in all sorts of relational, psychological, physical ways. And bit by bit by bit, that spirit has them and takes them. And they become that. But we recognize the reality of that apart from the instantiations. And we recognize that likely no human instantiation ever fully lives up to the spirit. But in fiction, we can play around with that. Even in fiction, that instantiation can in some ways get closer because it's within an arena that we can sort of work through in order to highlight the instantiation. And that's why it's a work of art. But even then, we have an understanding that there's a spiritual instantiation even above the one that we discover in fiction.
And at the moment, the best one I've got is the shallow pond of empathy, which is, at the moment, something which appeases people and does not cause them any discomfort immediately is always prioritized, even if the net effect of that over the long term results in their suffering.
Absolutely.
It's the toddler.
That's exactly what the Oedipal situation is. It's the prioritization of short-term emotional comfort over medium to long-term thriving, right?
And he just, with that illustration, re-knit in back the sacrificial conversation, because remember that preceded it. And what you need to do is make sacrifices with some goods. You always sacrifice goods. Sacrifices for some goods, so greater goods later on. And that, of course, is within a context. And you bargain with a person.
The mother who kicks the child out of the nest says, this is going to hurt now, but the iterating consequences are positive.
Michelangelo's Pieta.
Right, exactly. That's right. And that's exactly right. And the moral of that story is that if you give up your children to the world, you will keep them. Right. That's the sacrifice of Abraham. Abraham is called upon by God to sacrifice his son. And he says, yes, so he doesn't have to. Right. You have to offer up your children to be broken by the world or you lose them. You undermine them. You destroy them. It's a very paradoxical truth. We were talking about patterns. Cain is the pattern of inappropriate sacrifice. He does everything second rate. He lies. He omits. He prevaricates. He pretends. He doesn't offer his best. Abel's the opposite. He offers his best, which means his light is shining on the hill, right? There's no hiding. He's giving it everything he's got. The covenant with God is that if you give it everything you've got, you will prevail. And that's what God tells Cain.
Which, to go through some of the threads from today, instinct, staying true to that instinct, honesty, saying what you mean, not prioritizing, avoiding someone else's or your discomfort in the short term in order to believe that this is something which is going to make you feel better over the long term. Yeah.
Well, that's a kind of sacrifice right there, is that you're willing to sacrifice your short-term physiological and psychological comfort for a medium to long-term benefit. It's the essence of sacrifice to offer this is something the atheists don't understand about the biblical narrative, is that the narrative insists that we live in a sacrificial relationship. It's the essence of humanity to live in a sacrificial relationship. It's like, well, is that true or not? Well, as you mature, your relationships are more sacrificial. It's less about what you, in your narrow sense, want right now, and it's more about what's good over the medium to long run, including other people. Well, that's a sacrificial relationship. Now, the covenant, you know, and this is a matter of faith. It's the matter of the deepest faith. Are you willing to act out the proposition that the way to make the world reveal itself to you in its most positive guise is for you to adopt the most appropriate sacrificial relationship? Well, it's a big risk, isn't it? Because you have to give up everything. That's the deal. You give up everything that's low. Everything. Well, that's what the Christian passion is, because the Christian passion is an archetypal story, because Christ is the person who sacrifices everything thoroughly, 100%. And the biblical notion is that there's no difference between that and the descent of the God of the Old Testament into the space of human reality. So God is elaborated as a spirit in the Old Testament. That's a way of thinking about it. Fleshed out, right, into the law and the prophets. And Christ presents himself as the embodiment of that. So imagine, here's a way of thinking about it. You can invite various spirits to possess you. That's what you do when you give way to rage. That's what you do when you give way to lust, let's say. You allow spirits to possess you. Well, what would you be like if you did nothing but allow the highest of spirits to possess you? Well, that's the question that's put forth in the New Testament. And part of the answer to that is, if you allowed the highest of all possible spirits to possess you, you would be able to confront everything that life could possibly throw at you. And that's what happens in the Christian passion, because the worst that...
Now, it's interesting here because, again, a critique of Peterson that I've made often, Glenn Scrivener makes, is that God is too passive and we are too active. But in this illustration, you see him reverse it. If you allow that spirit to possess you, and of course, in Christian terms, that is the Holy Spirit. If you allow the Holy, and Christians pray all the time, come Holy Spirit, come Holy Spirit, come. You invite the Holy Spirit into your life. And it's all this language that Christians use to invite the Spirit of God to come indwell them. Now, Christians don't generally use the word possess, even though we want to... Because possession tends to be a term of, let's say, violation when someone is possessed by an evil spirit. Christians usually use the word indwell. We invite the Holy Spirit to indwell in us because our agency is not destroyed by that spirit. We participate in that spirit.
That life can throw at you is the worst tragedy. And the worst tragedy is the worst death, the worst and most painful death inflicted on the least deserving person, right? That's the ultimate reach of tragedy. Okay, that's not enough. Christ has to confront that, and he has to confront malevolence. That's the harrowing of hell. So the idea is that to adapt fully to life, you have to allow yourself to be possessed by the spirit that will enable you to voluntarily face unjust suffering and death and evil. It's like, well, you got an argument against that? How could it be any other way?
One of the things that I think I see people respond to this degree of pressure when they think about what is going to happen long term. I have discomfort that is in front of me now that I need to face, that I need to go through if I'm going to get to something in the future that I think that I'm supposed to.
They haven't finished on the book and I am running out of time.
What have you got coming up next? What can people expect from you over the next few months?
Well, what I'm working on right now is I'm going to finish this book. Hopefully by the end of December. It'll be published in November, but I'm going to go on tour, weirdly enough, about the book, probably starting in January. I'm going to do an American tour, and then I think I'm going to go to Africa and to South America.
Because the book tours aren't quite what you're expecting from what you would call a book tour. Jordan Peterson's book tours are very different things. He basically gives away the book in his talks. That's what he does.
America and to Southeast Asia. That's the plan. And I'm very excited about this new book. I'm hoping it'll be the best book that I've ever written. It's going to be more difficult book than the last two were, but not as difficult as Maps of Meaning.
Do you mean
was
to consume?
Yeah, it's more.
We have to get a language. We have to get a handle on this consumer language about content and consumption. We have to get a handle on that language.
It's heavy. It's deeper.
Have you been fighting with trying to make it accessible?
No, not really.
Right.
I've been just trying to lay the argument out as clearly as I can. Like, and I think that'll do the trick. And I have to go over it again and edit it and make sure that it's no more obscure than is absolutely necessary. No, I want to lay it out so that it's comprehensible. And I've had a lot of success with the biblical ventures that I've already embarked on. I did a series on Genesis in 2017, which turned out to be quite influential. And then I just did a seminar on Exodus with a group of thinkers. And I know there's a hunger for analysis of deep stories. And I also have good people around me that can help me grind my way through the stories and understand them. And so I'm very much looking, I've been having quite a good time writing this book, actually. It's very difficult to write, but it's been extremely exciting and interesting. And I'm hoping, you asked me earlier, what would I consider success mm-hmm. with this book? I don't think that you'll be able to read this book and understand it and be atheistic. I think
Michaela said something about this earlier this year. The dad's going to write a book that's going to, wow, that's ambitious. I can't wait for this book to come out.
I can demolish this book. I don't think that you'll be able to read this book and understand it and be atheistic. I think I can demolish the atheistic argument permanently. And it's partly...
My favorite name for Jordan Peterson is the unauthorized exorcist. If he manages to pull off this exorcism, it'll be pretty amazing. But it is tied to the Enlightenment question. It deeply is.
It's a weird thing because it's not like all of a sudden people are going to throw themselves at the feet of God and worship. It's like it requires a reconsideration of what we mean by belief. And I walked through some of it. It's like, do you believe in the good? Well, the difference between believing in good and believing in God is it's a very narrow difference. Now, there are...
And another video I'm going to make is because earlier in this video, he basically begins his argument with the argument about morality and the good, which is exactly where C.S. Lewis begins his wartime radio talks that become Mere Christianity. It's amazing that this approach, they both share this approach.
Important differences, but it's still a narrow difference. And the thing is, if you don't believe in good, you're aimless. And if you're aimless, you're hopeless. And if you're aimless and hopeless, you're anxious and fractionated. And people can't unite in their beliefs. Like the alternative is not good.
Reversing the Enlightenment is no small task.
Well, hopefully we can save the best of the Enlightenment as well.
It's like Chesterton's fence of Chesterton's fence. Like how many different fences are in the field, so to speak, and if we've
right.
thrown this one out and we're trying to plug it back in, but which bit of it's going back in the ground?
One of the things that's very interesting, and I think people like Dawkins have started to realize this, and I know that people like Douglas Murray and Ayaan Hirsi Ali and Neil Ferguson have recognize this, is that with the death of God, many other things die, things you don't expect. And one of the things that dies when God dies is science, and no one expected that.
How so?
Because science as a practice is a religious practice. It's predicated on religious axioms.
Is it?
Well, you have to believe that there's such a thing as truth. You have to believe that the truth is understandable. You have to believe that understanding the truth is good. You have to believe that there is such a thing as good, right? So imagine, to be a scientist, you have to imagine that, first of all, that the world is comprehensible to the human intellect, but more, that if you investigate the mysteries of the material world, that that will be beneficial, right? Those aren't scientific claims. Those are metaphysical claims. And that metaphysical claim is nested in a story. You know, and the Enlightenment types, they've portrayed the scientific revolution as something contrary to the religious substrate. And that's not accurate. That's a French revolution. That's a Luciferian intellect history. It's not true. The universities grew out of the monasteries. That's where the universities came from. And science, as a widespread enterprise, got its start.
Remember that Martin Luther was an Augustinian monk. And of course, he went to teach in Wittenberg. The universities did grow out of the monasteries.
In the universities. They grew out of the monasteries. That's not questionable. Like if you go to Harvard or if you go to Oxford and Cambridge, it's just starkly evident. The layout of the colleges is a monastic layout. So the idea that there's...
And when they built Duke University, they put a church in the middle. And if you go to Wellesley College in Massachusetts, there's a church in the middle.
Some fundamental contradiction between religious belief and the scientific enterprise. There's nothing about that that's true. And part of the reason that we're losing the scientific enterprise right now is because we've unmoored it from its metaphysical substrate and it can't survive. If you're going to be a scientist, you have to put the truth above all else. Scientists are very rare. You have to believe in the truth to be a scientist. I think Dawkins believes in the truth, by the way. So he's an atheist, but he's much less of an atheist than he thinks. That's my impression. Lying scientists are atheistic or just malevolent. Dawkins is a truthful scientist, and insofar as he's pursuing the truth, and insofar as he believes that pursuing the truth will set you free, then he's walking down a path that's Christian to its core. Now, I know he doesn't like that idea, but he also doesn't like the fact that the scientific enterprise seems to be collapsing in terms of its, what would you call, reliability and validity everywhere. So...
I appreciate you, mate. I appreciate the time that we...
Watch the whole thing. We're up to 3 hours and 23 minutes. I think it's 3 hours and 28. The whole thing is great. And I'm going to be dipping into other pieces of it, too, because there's some real jewels in this thing. Hats off to Chris. Chris did a tremendous job. Jordan is sharp, healthy, moving. So can't wait till a year from now when this book comes out. I'm out of time. I got to run. Leave a comment.